Today's date is Friday, June 19th, 2009. We're at the Amelia Island Museum of History. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Norman Wesley, date of birth March 29th, 1929, place of birth New York City, New York. My name is Robert Hamer, and I will interview Mr. Wesley on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Don Hill, who will operate the recording equipment. During the course of the interview, we'll be discussing the following subjects. What was your period of service? During which conflicts did you serve? What was your rank? And where did you serve? But first, let's start by you telling us, Norman, what was your motivation in joining the Army back in October 1951?
In 1951, the Korean War was a very unpopular war, particularly among young people who didn't want to serve. I was one of the few who supported the war for various reasons. I believed it was justified, and I therefore felt that I had an obligation to back it up. Mm-hmm. If I believed in it, then I had an obligation to participate
sure.
in it. I understood that there were many people who did not support it, but they had a different way of looking at things. I was drafted, but I had already volunteered for immediate service, except that I was then told if I did that, I would have to serve 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to give up 3 years before I had just graduated from college, and I didn't want to give up 3 years before beginning graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
So I rejected that. I also rejected the offer of the chairman of my draft board, who said he could keep me out of the draft if I would go to law school.
Oh.
But I didn't want to obey the draft.
Right.
I just didn't want to have too many years interruption before I began preparing for my career.
Sure. So enlistment would mean 3 years. Drafting meant 2 years.
Yes.
Just to clarify that. Did you come from a military background? Was your
no.
father or uncles or anybody?
No. My father was one of those in-between years where he was too young for World War One and too old for World War Two.
Ah, okay. Good. So you were drafted in October 25th, 1951.
Right.
Where did you go to basic training?
At Fort Dix in New Jersey.
Gotcha.
I had 16 weeks of basic training.
Okay.
Was given a 30-day furlough at the end of that and sent immediately to Korea.
Okay.
So the way I look at it, I never served in the Army. That is, I had basic training, I served in Korea, and then I was let out.
Gotcha.
So I was never really sort of stationed anywhere.
What was your specialty in basic? Infantry?
It was heavy weapons.
Heavy weapons.
In basic training.
And what kind of weapons are heavy weapons, just to clarify?
Well, technically they're machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
Water-cooled and air-cooled 30-caliber machine
30
guns.
30-caliber.
Mortars.
Mm-hmm.
And recoilless rifles.
Okay.
And that, you know, led to one of my big scares, because the night before I was sent up to the front lines,
mm-hmm.
when I had just arrived in Korea, I asked the sergeant who was sort of indoctrinating me what my assignment would be when I was sent up. He said, well, you'll be either on a heavy 30 or a recoilless rifle. And I said, I've never even seen a recoilless rifle.
Yeah, yeah.
So he took me to a tent and he said, that's a recoilless rifle.
Right.
That was my indoctrination to the recoilless rifle.
So none of that came up in basic training?
Then not the recoilless rifle.
No kidding.
The rest of it did.
What is it? A long weapon? That
it's really like an artillery piece, but it's long and it's straight, and it's like a bazooka.
Hmm.
That is, there's a recoil in the rear that's equal to the blast from the front.
Okay.
And in fact, when the Koreans captured the first ones, they made the mistake of standing behind it when they fired it.
Wow.
So that was killing some of them. But we hated it.
Okay.
Because the blast from the back was visible.
Yeah.
So as soon as you fired one, everybody knew where it was.
Mm-hmm.
We called it the 10-for-1 platoon.
Okay.
Every time you fired one recoilless rifle shell, 10 enemy shells would come in.
Oh, no kidding. Wow. Did it take two men to actually operate that?
Yeah.
Wow. So someone that hold it, aim it, and someone to load it?
Well, you didn't really aim it. You aimed it originally, and it was stationary.
Okay.
And then somebody from the back would load it, and somebody from the front would just sort of make sure it was aimed properly.
So it was like a mortar, it was like a bazooka, it was like a rifle.
More like a bazooka, yeah. Not like a mortar.
Yeah.
Wow. A mortar is a high-angle weapon, where this is straight, and it's wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It is accurate as far as you can see.
Sure.
And to blow up things like bunkers or enemy tanks, perfect, except that as soon as you fire, everybody knows who you are.
Right. Going back to basic, any special memories from basic training? Any buddies that you met there that stayed with you for a while?
I did meet buddies who went with me to Korea, mm-hmm. and a couple of them went with me to my heavy weapons company. That was Howe Company.
Okay.
In an infantry unit, every fourth company is a heavy weapons company.
Gotcha.
So it would be A, B, C, D would be heavy weapons.
Oh, okay, okay.
H is heavy weapons. Wow. So that was great. They were with me. I was not on the same machine gun. The machine gun crew was four people. Mm-hmm. And I had a great, great crew. Mm-hmm. We were good friends. I loved being on a machine gun because I knew how to work it.
Yeah.
But then, after a few months, my records were checked, and it was discovered I was a college graduate. So they moved me to something mm-hmm. they thought required more, I don't know, skill.
Right.
They moved me to something they had newly created, they called counterfire. And my job then was to find enemy artillery and mortars. So that meant that I was assigned not to an outfit, but to a region.
Gotcha.
So I'd be in they'd assign me to a location. This is where you are.
Right.
Doesn't make any difference what other troops are around you.
Right.
So sometimes I'd be in a place, and the troops I was with would be moved to somewhere else and replaced by somebody else. It didn't matter. Mm-hmm. Whoever came up was responsible for taking care of me. You know, they had to get me food and water.
Sure.
But I was assigned to the location, not to the people.
So what did that entail? Did you go out on, like, the scout or
no.
reconnaissance?
You would get as close to enemy big weapons as you could get,
okay.
as high as you could get.
Okay.
The Korean War is all about height. You're always going after high ground.
Right.
We go after the highest ground that we control.
Right.
And we had groups of three. Mm-hmm. That we called them arrays. We would set up microphones in an isosceles triangle facing the enemy and wait for their guns to go off. As soon as the guns went off, we would start the microphones and record the sound. And from the sound, we would put them onto a cathode ray, like a television screen.
Okay. Yeah.
And figure an azimuth, a compass reading, mm-hmm. from where we were to those guns.
Right.
700 yards away, another array was doing the same thing.
Right.
And where the two lines crossed, we knew those were heavy weapons.
Wow. So then reported that back into...
And then we would radio that back to our headquarters, and they would give it to the artillery.
Right.
The problem with that was, as I pointed out, if I am giving a line from me to the enemy gun, I am giving the enemy gun a line from them to me.
Right.
And if they're listening to the radio, they could hear the same coordinates, except, of course, we sent them in code.
Right.
But the code was a very simple code. We called it a shackle code.
Okay.
And it was a 10-word or 2 words equaling 10 letters,
mm-hmm.
a 10-letter word in which no letter was repeated. Our favorite was girl wanted. Mm-hmm. So G would be 1, I would be 2, R would be 3, etc. And if we wanted to send a 1, we would send a G. Mm-hmm. Well, we were sending these all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying, you know, they're getting so many messages. They have all 10 letters. All they have to do is figure out the proper order.
Right.
And my lieutenant said, yeah, but they're in code. I said, you can't make up a shackle code. It would take me 5 minutes to break.
Yeah.
So he tried it. It didn't take three.
Yeah.
And then he said, yeah, but you're an American. I said, yeah, but they have cryptographers. These people are experts in code.
Sure.
And he said, no, you're right. Well, sure enough, we got a direct hit right on my bunker.
No, no kidding.
With their biggest mortar, too.
Oh, wow. Wow. Jeez. Now, what was your rank at the time here?
At the time, private.
Private. So this is a pretty important job for a private to have.
Well, as a matter of fact, they kept moving me up, and I was training people, but I had I had problems with my officer.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. But now, was this successful, these missions successful for you? Did you knock out a lot of the enemy stuff, you know, through your coordinates and things like that?
We were real professionals. Yeah. In fact, part of the problem was we didn't even need to do some of this work sometimes, because as soon as we heard the sound, we knew exactly where that was.
Yeah.
In fact, we gave them names. There was one group we called Sprague's Mortars, because Sprague was the first guy to find them.
Hmm.
But they were sort of hidden behind an overhang, so the artillery never really got them.
Okay. So what was everyday life like in Korea? Where'd you live?
Well, first of all, let me make this distinction.
Sure.
By the time I got there, the worst fighting was over.
Okay.
So what I'm about to say is not typical of the early days.
Okay.
But most of the time, you'd be in a bunker. I expected when I went over there to be in a foxhole, the way I'd seen in the movies. But right. By then, the positions were well enough established that they weren't so temporary as the foxholes. They actually built structures.
Mm-hmm.
So you dug holes in the earth facing the enemy.
Right.
You put up sandbags all around and poles and crossbeams, and then you put your ponchos over the crossbeams
mm-hmm.
to ward off the rain, and then put sandbags on top.
Okay.
So it was like a little sandbag hut.
Okay.
And depending upon the situation, they could be bigger or smaller.
Sure.
You slept on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
The worst memory, I don't have any bad memories of
Fifth Grade,
but the worst memory was sleeping on the ground and being awakened by a rat running across.
Oh. Yeah.
And one thing that made them bad is they were carrying disease,
mm-hmm.
which was killing, had about 80% fatality.
Wow.
We called it hemorrhagic fever. They didn't know what it was at first, and they didn't know how to treat it. And later, much later, I learned that hemorrhagic fever is a general classification. It doesn't name a specific disease,
okay.
but a kind of a type of disease,
yeah, yeah.
which we call it hemorrhagic because the corpuscles on the skin would burst.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So there'd be hemorrhages all over.
Hmm. So what about food and
well,
other things?
We had sea rations.
Okay.
And they would be delivered, I've forgotten how many, two times a week, I think.
Okay.
We'd get a cardboard box with 4 days' supply of food, of sea rations. If we were relatively hidden, we could make a fire and heat them.
Okay.
But otherwise, we had to eat them cold. Water, that was a problem. Water was at the bottom of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
They had big Lister bags.
Right.
And, of course, the water was all purified. We couldn't drink any other water because that was all too dangerous.
Right.
But you had to get down from the mountain with a 5-gallon metal can,
right.
fill it up with 5 gallons of water,
mm-hmm.
and then climb back up the mountain carrying that 5-gallon can.
Yeah.
Of course, in the meantime, you're also carrying your rifle,
pack.
And your helmet of just 3 pounds.
Right.
And these were real mountains.
I mean,
it was hard enough just to climb the mountain.
Sure. What about things like, did you ever get any mail or anything like that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
there'd be regular mail calls. We'd have to go down the mountain. The Jeep would come up from the rear.
Right.
And I can't remember how often, but fairly, very often.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd bring mail. And also rumors.
Again,
all kinds of rumors.
Yeah. What were some of the rumors that you heard while you were there?
Well, the worst one was one guy came up, and he was a new Jeep driver with the mail, and he said, got any poop? And he said, yeah, some corporal got it yesterday. And he said, you know who? He said, some guy with a B. Corporal with the name of B. Could have been Breck, and he was my closest friend among those who got killed. And I'm really ashamed of this because I kept thinking other guys would be. Are you sure it wasn't this guy? Are you sure it wasn't Branch?
Yeah.
I had nothing against Branch. Branch was a very nice guy, but anybody but Breck.
Sure.
So every time I think of that, I feel, you know, ashamed of myself.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Tell us a little bit about the weather, too. What was it like?
The weather?
Swings of cold and hot.
Yeah. The weather was more extreme than here, I mean, than most places in America.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking in comparison to New York. So the winters were much colder than New York,
mm-hmm.
than New York's winters. The summers were much hotter. But even though it was hotter, it was more endurable. That is, I remember once, it was 108 degrees, and we had to march 18 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, could I march 18 miles in 108 degrees in New York? And I'd say, that would be too rough. But we didn't have any trouble at all.
Right. Interesting, yeah.
Of course, we were in much better shape.
What about diseases and stuff that came with the different changes in season?
The only diseases that I was aware of came through either drinking the water or swimming in the water. We had one guy who really came, I don't know what it was. I mean, we had to be able to airlift it out because he'd gone swimming someplace.
Yeah.
And I wasn't aware of any other real disease, you know, except the things that pop up every once in a while for anybody. But it's the only winter I ever went through in my whole life without a cold.
Oh, okay. And how about medics and things like that? Did they have people who assist you when people got sick?
Right. Yeah, but they weren't with us.
Okay. I mean, they were down the hill.
You had to wait until you could get somebody back to them.
Sure.
Ready, everybody?
Okay.
So, Norman, tell us, did you have any other assignments over there? Did your job shift a little bit while you were there?
Temporarily. There was a need for riflemen, and so I became a rifleman. And when I had that job, a further need developed for what they called a BAR man, somebody to carry the Browning automatic rifle.
Gotcha.
Now, an automatic rifle is really like a machine gun, except it's not shaped like one. It's like a long rifle. It's very, very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
It's as accurate as you can see.
Mm-hmm.
If you can see it, it'll hit it.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the rate of fire anymore, but it's a very high rate of fire.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble with it is it's very sensitive. Any dirt that gets into it will disable it. So you take great pains to keep it clean, but if you're in a situation where you need it, you can't be you can't be tending to it all the time. You're getting dirty.
Sure.
One of the things about all this is you're always dirty.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I didn't have to do that very long.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned several different kinds of weapons, heavy weapons and things like that. Was there any ever trouble with the ammunition to support the weapons that you had? Any issues in that regard?
Well, there were two kinds. By the time I left Korea, my personal weapon was an automatic carbine, an M2 carbine. And I had a lot of trouble keeping that functioning because it was faulty, or maybe the whole series was faulty. The other kind of trouble I had was not personal, but when I needed artillery help, there was an occasion. Artillery, of course, is not used for individuals.
Right.
You only fire for groups.
Sure.
And at one point, there was an enemy concentration of groups in front of me, and I called for artillery support. And the reply I got was, "Sorry, we fired at our 18 rounds for today.
Wow.
Try us again tomorrow."
Yeah. So they were rationing the weapon.
Yeah,
the
that's
rounds.
All they had. They were allowed to fire 18 rounds of artillery. I suppose they had a supply in reserve in case there was a real emergency.
Sure.
But I was no emergency.
Sure. Do you ever have any instances where you did hand-to-hand combat or anything like that? Did you ever get that close to the...
Oh,
you
know,
you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, by the time I was there, the combat was always at night. And what I remember about it is how thrilling it was.
Really?
Because, excuse me, to begin combat at night, you use flares. And the flares are various colors. And they go up and they light it up, and then they go dark, and then others light up. And it's like the 4th of July, you know, all these fireworks going up. It was thrilling. And then you see red lights headed towards you. That is, people are firing tracer bullets. Mm-hmm. And every sixth bullet is a tracer. And you see these, and I'm thinking about how beautiful this is, and I thought, hey, this isn't beautiful, this is deadly.
Yeah.
And I had the feeling that I had once when I was a civilian, when I got into a card game and found out the stakes later and realized if I lost, I couldn't pay. And I had the same feeling when I saw those tracer bullets coming at me. I said, you can't afford to lose.
No.
This is one time you can't lose.
Right. Wow. Were the North Koreans, were they good fighters? Were they?
Yeah, they were good fighters, but we fought two different kinds of enemy. The North Koreans, for whom it was a civil war,
mm-hmm.
and the Chinese, for whom it was like us. They were outsiders forced in.
Right.
So when we came into a new position and replaced other soldiers, we would say, what are we facing, North Koreans or Chinese?
Right.
And if they said Chinese, we relaxed. Mm-hmm. If they say North Koreans, we said, then you never surrender, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
You do not want to be a prisoner of the North Koreans. You can count on the Chinese to be at least relatively humane.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not as much as we are, but, you know, endurably. But the North Koreans, at least, I don't know the source of this. You understand this?
Sure.
This is just passed on.
Sure.
Whether it's accurate or not, I don't know. But that was the perception.
Did you or your group capture any prisoners of war, North Koreans or China?
We did. I never had any direct connection.
Okay.
Sometimes we would send over pamphlets. Mm-hmm. That is, sometimes instead of artillery, when the shell exploded, pamphlets would flutter out, and they would also be safe conduct.
Mm-hmm.
They would be propaganda, telling them, you know, they don't have a chance, why don't they give it up?
Sure.
And offering them good treatment if they would surrender, and
right.
using this as sort of safe passage. And I remember one time a Chinese wanted to surrender, and he came, he couldn't find anyone to surrender to. He went right through our lines, didn't see anybody, kept going. He got back into the rear, and he couldn't help himself. The guy came to surrender, and the first officer that he saw, he punched. And,
wow.
Of course, they subdued him and took him prisoner.
How was their weaponry, the North Korean Chinese?
Their weaponry was simpler but better.
Okay.
They had a kind of submachine gun.
Mm-hmm.
We had them, too. We called them grease guns. They were very slow and not very accurate. They had a kind of gun that was very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
We called it a burp gun,
right.
because it sounded like that. It would go brrr, brrr. It was very fast. It was very cheap. But in bigger weapons, what they would do is they would make their weapon bigger than ours. So if we had an 80 millimeter mortar, they would have an 81 millimeter mortar.
Yeah.
So their 81 millimeter round wouldn't fit into our 80.
Oh, okay.
But our 80 could fit into their 81.
Gotcha.
So whenever they captured ammunition, they could use it. When we captured it, we couldn't.
Oh, that's pretty smart. Didn't think about that.
So they really made the best of things.
Sure, sure. Change the subject just a little bit. And looking at your application for today's interview, I see here that you've received several medals and service awards. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, they were pretty well standard. The ribbons were sort of automatic. You got a UN ribbon if you were there a certain amount of time. You got, an American Korean ribbon. Later on, you could not accept any kind of decoration from a foreign government
mm-hmm.
for many years. But apparently, a few years ago, that restriction was lifted. And I got a ribbon and a medal from the Korean government, which was not legal until then.
Right.
The other things I can think of, well, I got a combat infantryman's badge.
Okay.
That's something infantrymen are very proud of.
Right.
I think I even remember the citation exactly. It's for direct participation in ground combat against an armed enemy of the United States. And no matter what you wear, no matter how many medals you've got, and sometimes you see high-ranking officers with chests sure. full of
ribbons and stuff, yeah.
The combat infantryman badges always has to be on top.
Gotcha. Very impressive. Any others that you can...
And then there were two bronze medals, which I don't want confused with the bronze medals that are awarded for valor.
Okay.
These bronze medals are awarded for participation in major campaigns.
Gotcha.
So, according to this, I was in two major campaigns, but I have no idea what they were.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. While you were on the front lines, did you ever get an opportunity to go down off the front line for a while to get warm food, warm shower, any leave, anything like that?
Yeah. Periodically, you could come down for a shower
mm-hmm.
and clean up and, you know, I guess have a rest for a while.
Sure.
At one point, though I was I was the lowest ranking man in the whole Army, but at one point I was in charge of my group.
Okay.
And my policy was, I just refreshed my memory reading letters last night.
Sure.
My policy was, when they went down, they could decide when they want to come back up.
Hmm.
Because nobody abused that.
Right.
They would go down, come back as soon as they should.
Sure.
You know. And I never said you have to come back.
Sort of like an honor code. Everybody
more or less.
Yeah.
And that's more or less how I did things.
Right.
We had equipment that was supposed to be secret.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told our first responsibility is to the equipment. Do not let it fall into enemy hands.
Right.
So if you're attacked, you have the choice. You can stay and fight, or if you think that would endanger the equipment, you can take the equipment and leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I never wanted to have the responsibility of somebody dying because I said you had to stay and fight.
Right.
What I would do is say, look, I'm going to stay.
Mm-hmm.
If you leave, I will say you have my permission.
Right.
But nobody ever left.
Interesting. So being back down for a rest break, so to speak, did the rest of the troops yourself use that time to like write letters home?
Oh, yeah, we did that.
Things like
we did. You also got into... If the weather permitted, you played ball.
Okay, good.
You know, we had a ball team.
Great.
In fact, one of the advantages for me was that I played baseball.
Hmm.
And remember I said that I was attached to an area, not people.
Right.
So I was always separated from the rest of my company.
Right, right.
And when a changeover occurred, there'd be a whole bunch of new guys who didn't know me. When I came down from the hill, I would be on the ball team.
Right.
And suddenly everybody knew me.
Yeah. That's a great story. I want to ask you a little bit of a different question now. Was there anybody that you encountered, that you met, that became like a role model to you, anybody that inspired you for during that time that you were in the Army and later on?
I can't really say that. There were plenty of people I respected.
Right.
In fact, I'd say I respected everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But no one that I modeled myself after.
Gotcha.
The intimacies exceeded anything I ever knew before or have known since.
Mm-hmm.
You become so close that it becomes almost supernatural.
Yeah.
You know, obviously this has to be a coincidence, but this is an example that sticks in my mind. I had two buddies that were closer than any other. I was close to all of them.
Right.
I mean, everybody in the platoon. I mean, looked at the letter I wrote yesterday and I said, I feel as though anything in the platoon is mine.
Right.
All I have to do is ask somebody to give it to me without any problem.
Right.
But there were two that were really close. We were inseparable.
Hmm.
And they both left before I did because they'd been there longer.
Right.
I was supposed to leave somewhere around, say, mid-April. But for a variety of reasons, I didn't leave until the middle of May.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get home until early June. As soon as I walked into the house, the phone rang.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of these two guys.
Wow.
I said, how did you know I was home? Did you meet somebody from the ship?
Yeah.
He said, no, but I've been thinking about you all day. I had a call.
That's great.
And, you know,
yeah.
I'm not trying to explain it, but
no,
that's
no,
the
no.
kind of intimacy you felt.
Sure.
You felt so close.
Now, have you stayed in touch through the years?
No. We did initially, and then we lost touch.
You sort of looked out for each other and made sure everybody was safe and home.
And you wanted to see them,
yeah.
And it's sad. The affection is still there.
Yeah.
But there was nothing in common.
Yeah.
You know, what you have is your memories together.
Right.
And then after you've talked about that, you don't have anything to talk about.
Right, right.
And of course, you're separated all over the country.
Sure, sure.
But I remember them with the same affection.
Sure. So other than the time down below the hill for brief periods of time, did you get any chance to go and leave or anything like that?
Right. We all got a chance that came around after about 7 months. It varied somewhat, but about 7 months. They called it rest and rehabilitation, R&R. And that meant a trip to Japan for 5 days.
Wow.
There were three cities in Japan that were designated as R&R centers.
Mm-hmm.
And they would send you to one of these. Everybody looked forward to that as the highlight of, you know, of their time over there. And when I got mine, I delayed mine because one of my buddies was due to go home before his R&R could come in.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me to trade with him. So I took his later R&R because I would still be there, and I gave him my earlier one. And I didn't mind because I still had it to look forward to.
Sure.
But I loved it.
Yeah.
And what you did was, you didn't take any salary for 4 months, and you saved up all that money and used it to enjoy yourself in Japan.
What are the kinds of things that you do? Go to the bars, dance?
You'd go to the bars. You know, of course, you go to a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
You try to find a nice hotel and stay there for the whole 5 days.
Right.
And you try to make sure you had no money left. I used to say this, they're not going to find any money on my corpse.
Yeah, right.
And one of the things you did was you'd send gifts home.
Yeah.
You always try to maintain contact and make, you know, and make sure that people back home realize you still love them and cared about them.
Who was back home for you at this time in your life?
My parents and my sister.
Gotcha.
Younger sister, 8 years younger.
Gotcha. Good, good. Did you have any trouble going back psychologically, knowing that you're going back to the front and all that?
No.
Okay.
No. One thing I loved back, everybody was telling me to bring back liquor for them. They're giving me liquor orders. So I bought a case of liquor. And I had a duffel bag, so I had to carry the damn case and on a plane. And I got back and started distributing it and forgot to save a bottle for myself. I never got a drink out of the whole case.
Did they provide you with beer and stuff down
there? Beer, yeah. There was a beer ration.
Oh, okay.
And we would get, I've forgotten whether it's, I think twice a week.
Okay.
You'd get four cans of beer or something like that.
And that was... Nobody abused any of that stuff. I mean, I would imagine you couldn't do too much with four cans of beer.
No, you couldn't. That's about it.
Yeah.
You know, some guys couldn't even handle, you know, one or two. There's one guy in our outfit who was drunk on one beer.
Sure, sure. So your tour sort of wound down, and I think you had mentioned earlier.
By the way, let me say something about that R&R leave. Some people argued about Dwight Eisenhower as president.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no doubt that he was the greatest president-elect in history.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was scheduled, when he was elected, it was on the promise, if elected, I shall go to Korea.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Korea when I was on R&R. And he took up every plane available.
Oh, wow.
So they couldn't send me home.
Wow.
And my R&R was 4 days longer than anybody else's.
Oh, right. That was a good thing. That was good. Who was the commanding general at the time?
Well, our general was a guy named Huddleston,
okay,
who left Korea to go back and run for governor of Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow.
And lost. He didn't become.
Okay.
But he alienated us because as soon as he got back, he complained that the troops were being pampered.
Oh, okay. Wow. So you were winding up your tour in June, I think, of 53. How were you notified that you were going to go home? Did you sort of know that or your time was up? Or?
Well, going home is something everybody plans for. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, there's a point system.
Right. Okay.
You go home when you get 36 points. You get 4 points if you're in combat.
Okay.
Every month, this is.
All right.
3 points if you're just behind. 2 points if you're in the rear.
Thanks for explaining that. I didn't realize that. Yeah.
And I was totally... You go before you go over, you have distorted views of what the reality is.
Mm-hmm.
I thought If you're in combat, you spend 9 months in combat, and then that gives you 36 months points, and you go home. But you never spend 36 months. Nine months in combat. They rest you.
Right.
You have to come back and and be rested. And
so your status changes.
So yeah, and when you're being rested, you're not getting that many points. So. I was scheming to get out of there before the winter because I was afraid of the Korean winter. I'd heard so much about it. But it turned out that I was there till May.
Yeah.
I left my outfit on May 13th.
Gotcha.
And this was long after I had 36 points because after you get the 36 points, you're eligible. That doesn't mean you automatically leave. There has to be a ship available to take you.
Right.
And so I had to wait for a while. And I found out from some guy working in the orderly room, by the way, a minor league baseball player,
right,
who had access to all the information, and he saw me outside once, and he just yelled out, "How does May 13th sound?"
Yeah, yeah.
So I knew that meant that's when I was going.
Good for you. Good. So how'd you process on up? May 13th, you left by ship. What base did you go to when you got home?
Well, when you leave your outfit, they put you in a truck, and I guess it must be different in different areas, but wherever we were, they took us to a city called Chuncheon. And there you turned in the combat equipment, you're given different kinds of equipment, filled out certain forms. You had to pass a physical.
Mm-hmm.
From there you went to Incheon, which is a seaport.
Mm-hmm.
And from Incheon, your ship might go, I think, to at least two different American ports.
Okay.
Mine went to Seattle.
Seattle.
I think it's possible that some of them went to California.
Okay. So you're temporarily assigned to a base in Seattle, and you're there for...
Not even really assigned. When the ship landed in Seattle, we were immediately put on a plane. We were given a chance to use a telephone.
Okay.
See, it's not like today where troops in the field can be in contact with people back home.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way to be in contact,
right,
except write letters.
Right.
So when we got off the ship in Seattle, they let us use the phone,
mm-hmm,
to tell our parents that we were safely home.
Right.
When my mother answered the phone and heard my voice, she dropped the phone.
Wow. Yeah.
And my father picked up the phone, and he was so nervous. All he could talk about was Gil Hodges' batting slump.
The Dodgers.
Yeah.
How old were you at this timeline?
By that time, I was 24.
24, and your rank was private first class?
Private first class, just before I left.
Just before
they sneaked me through.
I'm not going to ask you about those issues you had with the leadership, I guess.
Okay.
It sounds like you were a leader of your own, though. You stepped to your own drummer there.
It turns out, when I left, a whole group of guys came to me and they said, "Don't worry, we're going to follow, we're going to keep your tradition." I didn't know I had a tradition.
Yeah, sure.
But the only tradition I had was to think for yourself.
Yeah.
But there's a long story about this problem I had.
So if you want to talk about it,
sure,
tell us about it.
When I was on the front lines, remember, I was attached to an area, and I had to be supplied by whatever other troops were in the area. Well, at one point, we weren't being supplied.
Hmm.
We went 7 days without any water, except what was in our canteens. That meant, you couldn't wash.
Yeah.
You got to the point where you couldn't stand the way you smelled.
Hmm.
So we got out in front one day and we just started chanting, "We are dirty, we are filthy, we smell like rats."
Hmm.
And the company commander came rushing over and said, "Supply these men with water." Well, right after that, we were sent back. Our troop went into reserve. And we were sitting on the ground being lectured to.
Hmm.
It was winter. We were sitting on the ground. And the first lecturer was a medic. And he was lecturing us on group living. And he said, "The biggest danger in group living is the fear of epidemic. And the most important thing in an epidemic is to stay clean."
Hmm.
I have never seen mass hysteria before. Guys were rolling on the ground. That's all we
That's
wanted
funniest thing that ever
was to get clean.
Yeah.
And the company commander called all the platoon leaders, lieutenants, and said, "Quiet your men down. They're out of control."
Yeah.
So our lieutenant came to us and he said, men, things are not that bad. You still have your steel pots. When you're in combat, you wash out of your helmet."
Right.
And that was too much for me. And I said, "Sir, That's all right for us little men, but some of the bigger men can't fit into Disney parks.
Beautiful.
From then on, I had an enemy.
That's cute. That's a good story. That's a good story. So you're on your way home. Let's get you back home.
Okay.
You're on your way home, and you. I see here that you're. I think your separation date was July 24th, 1953. Does that sound right here? It's on your application?
Yeah, that's right.
And I see here that you have your discharge papers here. We'll make that part of your file and the record here.
But that isn't discharge. That's just separation.
Separation date. Okay. What's the difference?
The difference is you serve for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And after you serve your active duty, you're not discharged because you still owe 6 years.
Okay.
So you're on, well, it depends on what you decide. You could be on an active reserve unit,
right,
in which you go to monthly meetings and all that. Or you could be what I think they called it standby reserve.
Okay.
And that meant you were available.
Yeah.
And they actually invoked that once.
Okay.
When France and England and Israel attacked the Suez Canal, we were opposed to that action.
Okay.
And President Eisenhower was threatening to intervene.
Hmm.
And I got a postcard that said, get your affairs in order so you can leave on 24 hours notice.
Wow. Yeah.
I didn't really feel like fighting the English and the French and the Israelis.
Right. Okay. So it was just sort of heads up notice, but you never really got activated.
No, because they never did send troops.
I think they call it the inactive reserve. I think that's what the title is.
Could
that's
be.
What they call it now, anyway. So you got home. What did you do? Did you go back to school?
Well, I had a vacation because it was July 24th.
Right.
But the first thing I did when I got back was try to get into a graduate program.
Gotcha.
I had applied from Korea.
Okay.
So I thought my document should be there, but I hadn't had a chance to get a reply. And I went to NYU.
Okay.
and asked if they had acted on it. And they hadn't really acted on it yet, but the director of admissions that I spoke to looked at it at the time, and he said, no problem, we'll accept you.
Yeah.
So then I knew that in September I'd be starting graduate work.
Good, 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 good. And so you went and you got your graduate degree.
Right.
Okay. And what did you do after you graduated? What?
Then I got a job teaching English in a college.
Oh, great. Where, right in the New York area? Or?
Initially in Poughkeepsie.
Poughkeepsie.
New York. And then, after only 1 year in Poughkeepsie, then I moved up further north to a branch of the state university system.
Mm-hmm.
So for the last 45 years, I taught in the state university system.
Oh, good for you.
So 5 years before that. First, I taught it. When I was at NYU, I was teaching there.
Right.
But then one year at Poughkeepsie, it was 5 years, and then 45. So I taught 50 years in all.
Good for you. Congratulations. Congratulations. That's wonderful. And you retired in what year?
08.
08. All right. And so you decided to leave New York area, and you came to Florida, Nassau County.
Yeah.
And how did you find us here?
Well, one thing that led me here was a recommendation from a student.
Mm-hmm.
A student told me that her father had moved down here and built a house on the beach. And she told me that it was wonderful. My wife had seen something about it on TV.
Oh, okay.
A decorating show had shown a home.
Oh, really?
And she was impressed. But it was only glimpses,
mm-hmm.
because it wasn't about the media, it was about this home.
Right.
When we were thinking about retiring ultimately, my wife also was teaching in a college in the same town,
mm-hmm.
different college. We arranged to take a leave at the same time. And she said, we have to have a 10-year plan. So we thought of what we wanted in a retirement home. We wanted to get away from those New York winters. No more snow. That was part of the plan. And we wanted to be on a seacoast. So we flew down to Wilmington, North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
rented a car, drove the entire coast south, then went up the west coast. And we saw a lot of places that we thought were very nice. but they didn't feel like places we'd want to live in. They didn't seem like home. When we saw Fernandina Beach, we said, now this feels like home. Mm-hmm. But we were only here a few days, because it was during this long drive. After we got back, during another break, we said, let's spend a week on Amelia Island and see if we like it as much as we think.
Sure.
On the second day, we bought a house.
Yeah.
We had no idea when we could live in it because we still were working. We didn't know when we'd retire.
Right.
We thought this would be maybe 3 years in the distance. Actually, it turned out to be about 2 years.
Good. Good.
But we knew we want to have it in place. This is where we want to end up.
Good for you. Good for you. Now that you're here and retired, what do? You have hobbies? Do you have anything to do for fun?
Well, the main thing that takes up our time is a book group that we formed. The library asked us to create a book group for Friends of the Library.
Yeah.
And we started it as soon as we came down here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's grown since. There are as many as 25 people turn up sometimes.
Sure.
Even more, about 30 altogether. And it's one of the most exciting experiences I've had.
That's great.
It's all highly intelligent.
Yeah.
We both have, my wife and I have the same attitude that it's their book club, not ours, so we don't try to run it.
Right.
And they select the books. I was saying the other day, I feel as though they keep assigning reading to me all the time.
Yeah.
I'm always reading because they have a book coming up.
Yeah.
And they all have ideas. They all want to talk. It's the liveliest discussion you could imagine.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that a teacher would love to be able to have.
Sure. That's great. That's wonderful.
But that takes up a lot of our time.
What about golf, tennis, movies?
No, we don't
travel?
Do that, but we go to movies. I'm interested in music. We go to the chamber music concert. Marilyn loves the beach, so we walk on the beach as much as we
that.
Can.
Yes.
That's the exercise we get. I'm a sports fan, so I try to watch this. I have this Major League Baseball package on Direct, so I can see every game every day.
Except the Yankees or the Mets? The Yankees or the Mets?
I see the Mets and the Dodgers.
Mets and the Dodgers.
I grew up with the Dodgers, and I've never left them.
I get Joe Torre out there right now.
So the way it works out, I can see the Mets starting at 7, and when they're finished, I can see the Dodgers starting at 10.
It's getting all
up all night.
I rarely get to see the very end, though.
We're about to wind down the interview, but I would like to go back just a little bit and ask you to think about your military time and ask you if it had any kind of major impact on you, the way you thought about your life after the military, any ethical value system that maybe you developed through the military.
I think the military really supported an ethical system that was already in place.
Gotcha.
It gave me certain opportunities that I needed. That is, I had 2 years between college and graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
That gave me a chance, starting when I was 22, to decide what I want to do with my life, without the pressure of having to do it right then and there.
Sure.
I had 2 years to think about it. And it wasn't easy. I thought I was going to be a dentist.
Mm-hmm.
And I had made that decision when I was 18. But when I was 18, I didn't know who I was or what I wanted.
Sure.
As time went on, I became more sophisticated about it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was 24, I was able to ask myself, I realized I didn't want to be a dentist. And I said, well, what do you want to do? And I asked myself three questions. I said, what kind of guy are you?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of life do you want to live? And what kind of job will let you live that way?
Right.
But I couldn't have answered those questions when I was 18. I didn't know what kind of job I was, what kind of life I wanted.
So that time was sort of like you developed a maturity.
Yeah. Yeah, and a kind of insight.
Right.
And perspective.
Right.
The Army gave me a lot of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much the Army itself as the experience that is being in that country in a wartime condition, mm-hmm. and seeing how some people had to live. And it made me realize what I wanted out of life.
Now, you had mentioned earlier at the beginning of the interview that you were ready to serve. You wanted to serve. After you served, did you still feel the same way?
Oh, I felt I felt very happy that I had. I know that even at the time and afterwards, the war was controversial. Mm-hmm. You know, people called it Truman's War and all that. I'm not interested in the politics
of it. Right.
But I still look back at it with a feeling that I was where I should have been.
Right.
And I get a certain comfort from that, saying, okay, I did what I should have done.
Good for you.
No reservations, whatever.
It's been great. This has been a wonderful interview. I'd like to thank you
for
honoring us with your time and giving us your story on behalf of the Library of Congress and the Amelia Island Museum. We really, truly appreciate it, Norman. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. And thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. Really.